This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, Canada's largest and most influential association fighting for the interests of Canadians as we age. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer. Today, big ideas from two former Liberal stars. First, Sophie Grégoire Trudeau, now separated from the Prime Minister, talks about her personal growth journey and her book, Closer Together. And former Health Minister Jane Philpott outlines her prescription for fixing Canada's health system. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. In a historic move, the U.S. is planning to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. This week's proposal by the Drug Enforcement Administration, which still must be reviewed by the White House, would recognize medical uses of cannabis and acknowledge it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. But it would not legalize marijuana outright for recreational use. The U.S. birth rate last year reached the lowest levels since records began, ending an uptick during the pandemic. The Centers for Disease Control reports that new births were down 2% from the year before, well below a threshold that experts call the replacement rate needed for the current generation to replace itself, rather than grow or shrink. But the U.S. is not alone in this demographic change. China and Japan have been trying to encourage people to have more kids amid a major demographic shift on the horizon. A 60-year-old woman has made history by being crowned Miss Universe Buenos Aires. It's a big departure from ageist norms, and lawyer and journalist Alejandra Rodriguez says the judges saw her confidence and passion to represent the women of her generation. The Miss Universe organization announced that starting this year, there will no longer be age limits for pageant contestants, and every woman over 18 will be able to participate. Rodriguez will now go on to compete for the Miss Universe Argentina title. German tennis legend Boris Becker has been discharged from bankruptcy court in London, even though he fell far short of repaying his creditors nearly £50 million, or $62.5 million U.S. The judge acknowledged that he made a good-faith effort to return the money. Becker was deported to Germany 2 years ago after serving 8 months in a London prison for illicitly transferring large amounts of money and hiding £3.1 million in assets after he declared bankruptcy in 2017. Becker rose to stardom in 1985 at the age of 17 when he became the first unseeded player to win Wimbledon. He went on to become the world number one player, winning 2 titles at Wimbledon, 2 at the Australian Open, and 1 at the U.S. Open. The United Methodist Church, one of the largest Protestant denominations in the U.S., has voted to repeal its ban on LGBTQ clergy as well as its prohibition on officiating at same-sex weddings. Here in Canada, the Methodist Church merged with 2 other denominations back in 1925, and the United Church allows both LGBTQ clergy and same-sex marriage. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. It's not exactly a memoir, though the Prime Minister's ex, Sophie Grégoire Trudeau, talks about her struggle with an eating disorder, growing up as an only child, and meeting Justin Trudeau. Her book is about her journey to self-awareness and self-acceptance. I talked with Sophie Gregoire Trudeau about closer together, knowing ourselves, loving each other.
The lack of human connection is causing us to becoming ill physically and mentally, and we need more of human connection to heal us through this. That's why I wrote the book, so people can actually know themselves better and understand the wirings behind their own personality so they can have more emotional leadership.
Mental health is at the core of your advocacy, and it started with your eating disorder, and you spoke about it before that was very common at all. You said that you wanted to learn why this was happening to you. Do you feel that you have?
Absolutely. There was addiction on both sides of my family, and I talk about that in the book. And I think as an only child, I internalized a lot of it and, you know, couldn't know how to deal with it. Well, I was raised by some incredible human beings whom I still have a beautiful relationship with. But facing our truth hurts. And looking at our little or big trauma hurts as well. And trauma is not only the bad thing that happened to you that you have to deal with, but also the good thing that didn't take place, that you needed from a emotional nourishment perspective.
What about your own family and growing up as an only child?
I would say that in my case, there was a loneliness where I found solace and nourishment in others. And I think I also really wanted it deeply, this authentic connection.
Women in public undergo intense scrutiny, some of it, a lot of it, often hateful, and you probably had more of that scrutiny as a prime minister's wife. What conclusions do you draw from that experience, and how do you feel now?
Many. First of all, when we live in a society where we are rewarded for self-betrayal as women, we cannot age, we cannot look the way we do or act the way we do. We have to perform, but we have to be at home with the kids. We have to hold the emotional nucleus of the family, including our partners. So we grew up in unequal dynamics from an emotional perspective, and that really comes at a high price. Now, the lessons to learn are that we shouldn't be playing any roles. I never saw myself as Sophie, the wife of somebody, or the, you know, non-official first lady. I live my life as Sophie, and I adapt to the different environments that I'm put in or different life obstacles that come onto my path.
We have an older audience, and one of the things that's happening a lot now is what they call gray divorce, and it's people divorcing or separating after 30-plus years, and it's often initiated by women. So what would you say to those women?
Oh, so much. I was with a psychotherapist and ally, Esther Perel, while I've been here, and she has been a source of inspiration to me. She has really understood couples and relationships. The equation of success is marriage and divorce is failure is not realistic. And she said, longevity is not the sign of a successful relationship, but we applaud it as if it is the ultimate endeavor. It's great. Perseverance, long-term relationships is incredible, and we should celebrate it in some ways, but it is not the sign of success. And if you don't have that, it doesn't mean that you're facing failure. I feel that women are choosing their authenticity over their codependency and attachment, which we all have in some ways or another. When you love somebody, you have to set them free. If these women are understanding that they're setting themselves free from a relationship, we can end a relationship without saying goodbye forever. We can preserve its history. We can preserve its beauty. But it takes two secure people in order to put effort in this through time. And that is a sign of a successful relationship.
Do you feel that you have set yourself free?
I feel like we are two open-minded and open-hearted individuals who are putting effort into celebrating and preserving what we have and what it will be going on in the future. We are both emotionally invested parents who adore our family, and we still have each other's hearts and backs and minds. Yep.
Are you going to keep the Trudeau name?
So for now, I cannot answer that because it's as simple as I'm separated and we're still legally married. So I cannot answer that question at this time.
What would your advice be to the next woman who is in your shoes as the spouse of a prime minister?
That's always a tough question. I'm not here, you know, to be the to give kind of like direction to any other woman who will find herself in that position. And, you know, in Canada, because it's an unofficial role, the partner, whether it's, you know, she's male or female or gender diverse, I think you get to choose how you want to express your own creativity and authenticity through it all. And some people will, you know, will want to be away from the cameras and all that. That was part of my work, so it was more like a natural fit there. But I never changed. I always continued on the mental health path that I begun before going into politics and even before meeting Justin. So what I would suggest is to keep that authentic voice within you and to navigate it on your own path. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
No, I loved your questions.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
That was Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, author of Closer Together, Knowing Ourselves, Loving Each Other. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, a doctor's prescription for a healthier Canada. And she's not just any doctor.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP. Fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
If there's anyone qualified to figure out a fix for our health system, it's former Liberal Health Minister Jane Philpott, currently the Dean of the Queen's University Medical School. She's calling for a radical overhaul with one crisis at the core, the shortage of family doctors. I talked to Jane Philpott about her book, Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada.
Back in 1984, when the Canada Health Act first crossed the line, I think that really got things under control for quite a while. But we didn't follow through and actually make sure that we have a health system so everyone in the country has access to what I call a primary care home. Just like every child has access to a public school, we should be able to have a system that in your neighborhood, there's a place where every Canadian can go to be able to have a family doctor and an entire team to serve them. And so we've now gotten to the state where about a quarter of the population doesn't have a place to go to get primary care.
We all know that the shortage of primary care of family doctors, it's probably the biggest problem in our system. I think part of it is that young doctors, they don't want to go into family medicine. If they are in family medicine, they practice differently or they spend part of their time doing a different specialty. So how do you fix that?
Well, you're absolutely right. That is a very big part of the problem. And this is one of the things that I've spoken about in my book is that, you know, we haven't built this system. And it's a bit of a vicious cycle is because we haven't built a proper system, the conditions of work for family doctors right now are unsustainable. It doesn't look like a very attractive choice. And so many of our medical students are choosing to do other things. So we need to do the work we are doing at medical schools like ours at Queen's, where we are specifically building programs designed for training family doctors and making it attractive. But most of all, we need to actually build that system out there, support these family doctors to work in teams, and be able to deal with some of the huge administrative burden. You know, we don't send teachers out of teachers' college and then expect them to go and build a business and create a school and hire the teachers for themselves. We actually have a system in place that does that for them so they can focus on teaching. And we need the same for family doctors and other primary care clinicians.
We hear about every province making a stab at doing that. Here in Ontario, we have these Ontario health teams, but doctors who practice in sole practices say there are barriers to that. So is part of the problem that it's different in every province, or what are the biggest barriers to that?
Political will is the deepest thing that we're lacking. There are lots of politicians who speak hopefully about, you know, putting more money in the system and thinking that somehow that's going to actually fix things. But none of them have said, we are going to design a health system in this province that is rooted in primary care, where we are going to actually do the hard work of figuring out where we have, in every city in the province, tens of thousands of people who don't have access to care, and we're going to help create primary care teams. We're going to do that based on a standard. It's not going to be ad hoc, where everybody does their own thing, because that means it's immeasurable and inconsistent, but there should be a national standard for what a primary care team is, with funds from the federal government and with operationalizing from the provincial governments. But it requires, first of all, that fundamental commitment that 100% of Canadians need and deserve a primary care home.
And is the biggest barrier money?
No, in fact, it isn't, which is what's shocking. Sometimes you think, how could something be better and cost less? But in fact, that's the case. So there are many countries in Europe who actually have national systems where 100% of the people have a primary care home to which they're attached. They spend either the same or less than we do per capita on healthcare, and they get better results. So, it makes sense when you think about it, right? We've got all these people who aren't getting primary care. No one is doing their cancer screening and detection. No one is caring for their chronic diseases. They show up in emergency departments without having their cancer detected when it was first small and manageable. And the reality is we're waiting until things become expensive and sometimes untreatable. So this is really unacceptable for us as a country. We need to start with the front door of the health system, which is primary care, and build that properly, and we will actually end up paying less.
And what are the barriers to that? I've had a lot of personal experience of the health system. I find that often it's bureaucracy. So if you're getting home care for something, the bureaucrat who rations that would rather you go to the emergency than give you an extra 15 minutes of care.
Well, as you, I'm sure, experience that, that doesn't make any sense at all. And isn't the way that it should be. So, one of the things that I suggest is that home care actually needs to sit within that primary care team, where in the same place that your family doctor is.
What you're suggesting sounds a lot like the model for the Ontario health teams. Do you agree with that, or where do you see a problem in that model?
I would say there's still some lack of clarity as to what the Ontario health teams can and should do, and they certainly have not been resourced to do the kind of thing I'm describing. It could develop that way. I really love to use this metaphor of comparing it to a public school system, in which we have school boards who actually do the organizing, and they say, look, we've got this new subdivision being built. We must put a new school in there, or this school is getting overpopulated. Let's add a portable to it. That's what the Ontario health team could be if they were resourced properly for it and given a mandate clearly to say, we would like you to organize primary care, we would like you to map out where the gaps in care are, and we're going to support you to be able to develop that. That's the way countries that have done this effectively have actually managed to make sure that there is a guarantee for primary care.
Yeah, again, it seems like whenever we see proposed solutions, they're like Band-Aids.
Exactly. And Band-Aids are not going to cut it in healthcare. You actually have to figure out where the root of the problem is, and then you have to give a comprehensive solution.
Jane Philpott, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
That was Dr. Jane Philpott talking about her book, Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. She will step down as dean of the Queen's University School of Medicine in June 2025. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, Christine Ross, and Paul Thomas, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.